I'm going to go ahead and get started today on slide one. I realize a few people may still be joining us. On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training on strategies for monitoring the performance of DNAPL source zone remedies. Today's training was developed by the ITRC DNAPL team. My name is Juliana Cheatham, and I'm coming to you today from North Carolina. I'll serve as the moderator and cover a few introductory slides, and then turn our training over to our instructors. As we go through the slides today, you are in control of which slide we are on. The slide number is in the upper left-hand corner, and we'll be saying the number as we go through the presentation. If you're using the ClueIn system, the series of orange buttons at the top allow you to navigate through the presentation. The double left button takes you back to this first slide in the training. The single left button takes you back one slide at a time. Most often you'll use the third button that takes you forward one slide at a time through the presentation. The double right fast forwards you to the end of the presentation, and the house takes you back to the presentation overview page where you started today. The question mark button is there for our simulcast audience. Our simulcast audience is hearing the voice of today's training over the computer rather than a phone line. Anyone is welcome to use this question mark button at any time. When you select the button, a little screen pops up that allows you to type in a question that I will receive and then ask during the designated question and answer periods. If you're on our phone line, we welcome you to ask your own questions, but please wait until the designated question and answer periods. We'll have one at about the middle of today's training and then another at the end. Today's training class is based on a technical and regulatory guidance document titled Strategies for Monitoring the Performance of DNAPL Source Zone Remedies. This document is available to download at the end of today's training, as well as the slides for the training. In addition to the information that you see on the screen, the downloaded versions of the slide include speaker notes that provide additional details. Today's training is co-sponsored by the EPA Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. And in today's training, we're going to talk about DNAPL performance assessment. Despite the ever-increasing number of field applications of DNAPL removal technologies, many unanswered questions remain regarding the effectiveness of these technologies and how best to measure their performance with respect to site-specific remedial objectives. Today's training addresses specific issues dealing with the monitoring of performance of various DNAPL source zone remediation technologies. Performance is discussed in terms of effective and efficient progress towards the project goals. Elements of a robust performance monitoring program are described, including the need to establish appropriate performance goals and metrics well in advance. If you move to slide two, using that right arrow key, the third one along the top, I'm going to tell you a little bit about ITRC. ITRC's goal is to help people make better decisions. ITRC does this work through a network led by state regulators and including others in the environmental community. ITRC forms teams that create documents and training like today's internet-based training. The Environmental Council of States is the host organization, and ITRC includes members from almost all states, as shown on this map. For more information about ITRC, you can visit the website. The website address is listed on the top of the slide. The website includes contact information for a point of contact in each of the states shown in green. ITRC's federal partners include Departments of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency. On slide three, we have our list of topics for 2006. We're going to continue to offer many courses from last year and the year before, as listed on the left of this slide. We're also developing new classes right now that will be offered during 2006. You can see more details about our training, including information about each of the classes, a short paragraph telling you more about what to expect in the class, as well as our schedule throughout 2006. We also keep archives of previous trainings, and the website listed at the bottom of this slide will take you directly to that archive. On slide four, for those of you who have just joined us, along the left are some logistical reminders. If you can read over that, we'd appreciate it. On today's presentation, we're going to start with a performance overview and then performance metrics. Halfway through, we have a break for questions and answers. We ask that you hold all of your questions until that question and answer break. In the second half, we'll come back and talk about technology-specific tools, regulatory and stakeholder issues. At the end, I'm going to take you to some links to additional resources and show you our feedback form, We ask that everyone provide feedback leaving the site today. At the end, we have time for your questions. On slide 5, I'm going to introduce our instructors. All of our instructors are members of the ITRC Principal Team. Our first instructor is Eric Anderson. Eric is an environmental engineer with the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. He works in the Division of Environmental Remediation, advising staff on the selection and implementation of innovative technologies. Prior to working for New York State, Eric worked in the hazardous waste remediation field as a consultant to industry. Eric was the lead for the ITRC DeNaples team. Our next speaker, Dr. Constantinos Kostarellos, is a professor of Polytech University in New York. He's been involved with NAPL research over 10 years and started a new subsurface remediation center at Polytech that has yielded outstanding results in recovering coal tar from soil. His research not only focuses on subsurface remediation, but NAPL detection technology as well. Our third speaker is Ryan Wymore from CDM in Colorado. He has 8 years of experience in the field of environmental engineering, over 6 of which have been focused on innovative groundwater remediation technologies. Ryan currently specializes in enhanced bioremediation and monitored natural attenuation of chlorinated solvent-contaminated groundwater. If you move to slide 6, it is my pleasure to turn over today's presentation to Eric Hausman from the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. Eric?
Thank you very much. Today we'll be discussing strategies for assessing remedial performance at DNAPL sites, specifically the performance of in-situ treatment technologies which target the DNAPL source. I'll spend some time here at the beginning going over some background material, like key definitions, the uses of performance monitoring data, and setting goals, in order to lay a groundwork for more detailed technical material to follow. Dr. Constantinos Kostarellos will follow my overview with a discussion of performance metrics, including a discussion of the pros and cons of concentration-based metrics, the pitfalls of estimating mass removal percentages, and some techniques for measuring impacts of treatment on the downgradient plume. Mr. Ryan Wymore will then describe to you a number of source treatment technologies that are being used at DNAPL sites and specific monitoring parameters for each technology. And after he finishes, I'll come back and talk about a few health and safety issues associated with performance monitoring and mention a few regulatory and stakeholder concerns. And in between, as Juliana said, you'll have a couple opportunities to ask questions. The document we'll be discussing today is geared to those that have already made a decision to treat the DNAPL source as opposed to a source containment approach. We realize there are different schools of thought regarding the better approach for a DNAPL site. Whether attacking the source is always the right answer is not always clear. Whether you decide to actively deplete the source or simply contain the source or some combination, that will dictate the performance goals that need to be established. And individual state regulations and policies also factor into the remedial goals. Regardless, mass removal or destruction is a common goal and is the assumed course of action for this document. Let's move to the next slide, number 7. I hope you all had a chance to look at the material that we posted as a prerequisite. Performance monitoring for DNAPL source treatment is a fairly specialized and complex topic. We decided to gear the document in today's training to an audience that's already well-versed in DNAPL issues, for example, what they are, their behavior in the subsurface, and difficulties investigating and remediating DNAPL sites. So today's training assumes that you have a general working knowledge of DNAPLs and that you reviewed either this material or this document that you see here, the handbook for DNAPL treatment or DNAPL transport and fate, or some other background material. These and other recommended works are listed at the last slide, links to additional resources page. Moving to slide 8. Today, you will hopefully gain an appreciation for performance assessment, understand the importance of building and utilizing a valid conceptual site model, discover the benefits of a converging lines of evidence approach to performance assessment instead of relying on a single metric. You'll understand and appreciate some of the regulatory and stakeholder concerns, learn about some of the limitations of point measurements like soil or groundwater concentration data, and hear a bit about some state-of-the-art techniques for measuring performance. Let's move to slide 9. This slide lists three major points we'd like you to take away from today's seminar. First, we'd like to stress the importance of planning for performance assessment ahead of time. This involves working with the regulatory agencies, stakeholders, the rest of the project team to establish performance goals and metrics during the design prior to system startup. Planning for performance assessment is discussed in Section 3 of our document. Second, we want to stress that goals for the source zone need to be both measurable and achievable. For phase cleanups, alternate or intermediate goals other than MCLs should be considered to direct short-term remedial actions within the source zone. Obviously, MCLs still have their place for guiding longer-term restoration of a plume, but there is a need for more regulatory flexibility within the source zone itself in terms of goal setting in order to encourage more source treatment. Finally, we advocate an approach to performance assessment that relies on multiple or, you've heard, converging lines of evidence. This involves looking at all the monitoring data and feedback from a system in concert, you know, some of it qualitative, some quantitative, not basing your assessment on one or two rounds of groundwater samples, for instance. As we know, mean apple distribution in the subsurface is too complex and difficult to track using only one method to verify success. Move to slide 10. We consider performance to be effective and efficient progress towards remedial goals. Effective in the sense that the remedy meets or exceeds remediation goals, and efficient in terms of minimizing the time and effort needed to attain those goals. By monitoring various parameters or metrics, like rates of mass removal or operating costs, and comparing these to established targets, the technology's effectiveness and efficiency can be assessed. And then decisions can then be made to either stop or continue operation or transition to another remedial technology. These two aspects are introduced in Section 1.3 of the document. And later on, Ryan Wymore will discuss technology applications where metrics for assessing effectiveness and optimizing efficiency were utilized. Move to slide 11. Why measure performance? What are some uses of performance monitoring data? Obviously, you want to confirm the effectiveness. There's also some other uses. Performance monitoring data is used when optimizing system operation. Optimization involves getting feedback on how the remedial equipment is performing, the blowers and the pumps and the fluid extraction systems, and making adjustments if necessary. Performance monitoring data is also used to ensure that contaminants aren't being mobilized beyond the treatment zone. Some of the more aggressive technologies that we'll be discussing are designed to mobilize source mass. And without a way to monitor for unintended mobilization, you might be making things worse and not know it. One more important use of performance monitoring data is to help decide when to transition to another remedial technology as part of a treatment train. For DNAPL sources, a phased approach is usually warranted, comprised of a combination of one or more technologies in sequence. And this integration requires close monitoring in order to maximize efficient transitions. Move to slide 12. While the intent of our document is to help you plan a performance program that will meet the needs of the average DNAPL project, we all know that DNAPL remediation is not for the faint of heart. This includes performance verification. Certainly there are technical challenges to conducting a robust performance assessment having to do with site complexity or insufficient characterization. Other challenges, less technical in nature, may also act as barriers to adequate performance assessment. For instance, an adequate performance assessment program can be quite expensive. The cost of designing and implementing such a program that's tailored to a specific site using multiple tools might be considered too high for the typical budget. And this might result in falling back and relying on one or two single measures of success, like 90% reduction in groundwater concentration in one or two wells. But this leads to uncertainty. As we'll discuss later, there are ways to reduce level of uncertainty without breaking the bank. Another barrier, a lack of standard protocols or guidance on performance assessment strategies can make it difficult to interpret performance data and make comparisons from one site to the next difficult. A third barrier might be where remedial action objectives are vague or not specified. It can be very difficult to develop and apply a proper set of performance metrics, so you got to have a clear target before you start. Another barrier to a robust performance assessment might be that project managers are unsure about what matrix to measure, where it's most appropriate to measure, or how to design a performance monitoring program. And that's what we're here today to help you with. Move to slide 13. As I mentioned, performance goals should be tailored to the conceptual site model of the DNAPL source zone and account for the capabilities and limitations of the technology that you're using. Performance goals are discussed in section 3.1 of our document. EPA and others recommend a phased approach for DNAPL source zone remediation and advocate the use of intermediate performance goals. Rarely will you be able to remove all the DNAPL mass with one silver bullet technology. Most often you must rely on multiple coupled technologies in order to make effective and efficient progress. Performance goals, therefore, you got to consider the subsequent or follow-on technology. For example, if your long-term goal for a site might be restoration of groundwater to MCLs, such a goal is unlikely to be achieved with a single technology. Intermediate goals are therefore useful in guiding the interim removal action in the DNAPL source zone while keeping the overall site restoration goals on track. Each technology or process in the treatment train might have its own set of interim goals. What we're trying to suggest is that performance goals should reflect the space-specific nature of these cleanups and the anticipated response of the source zone to treatment. Slide 14. For the most part, the goal of a source zone remedy is to reduce the risk of exposure through ingestion of groundwater, inhalation, etc., coming from the source. With respect to DNAPL source zones, exposures can be reduced either by containing the source or depleting the source through treatment. In both cases, the mass of DNAPL leaving the source area is depleted or reduced, and thus the risk is reduced. But as we know, risk is difficult to measure directly and requires the application of judgment and site-specific assumptions about rates of exposure and slope factors and all. Regulators like myself usually prefer, in some cases required, to assess threats to the public health and environment on the basis of actual field measurements. These could be dissolved contaminant concentrations detected at some compliance point or some average post-treatment soil cleanup level. Although risk reduction is difficult to quantify, it can be approximated or broken down into field-based metrics that represent risk. Reduction in contaminant mass, reduction in concentration, toxicity, or mobility. Strategies for measuring these indicators of risk reduction are essentially what the document's about. the challenge here at this point is to define performance in terms of system parameters or metrics that respond to treatment and change as progress is made. Slide 15. Selecting performance metrics. The process of deciding which metrics are appropriate for a given project should involve the regulators, the technical team, and the affected stakeholders. This kind of mirrors the triad systematic planning phase. Agreeing on performance metrics and transition criteria up front can help avoid some frustrations and delays down the road that might result as data starts streaming in and decisions need to be made. Section 3.3 of the document discusses the basis for selecting performance metrics for DNAPL source treatment projects. They are defined for a particular project in terms of the performance goals and objectives established, the technology or series of technologies being used, the characteristics of the media, the location of nearby homes and businesses that might be affected, and finally the expected response of the subsurface to treatment, which is very often technology dependent. And then Section 5 of the document covers these technology-specific monitoring parameters that could serve as appropriate metrics. Slide 16. As I mentioned, some measures of performance are technology dependent. This slide lists some of the common technologies for treating DNAPL source zones. I'd like to stress that our intent is not to advocate the use of any one technology over another, but to provide examples of monitoring techniques and approaches to gauge their performance. In Section 5 of the document, we discuss technology-specific parameters for monitoring performance, and Ryan will get into that later. conventional DNAPL treatment technologies include DNAPL recovery using well pumping or baling, soil vapor extraction for the vado zone, or air sparging for the saturated zone. Some of the more innovative technologies recently to come online are thermally enhanced remediation, steam and electrical flushing technologies using surfactants or co-solvents, and in-situ oxidation and even in-situ bioremediation. All of these technologies alter the subsurface conditions near the DNAPL zone in ways that can be measured using fairly simple tools. For instance, product recovery will eventually lower the DNAPL saturation and decrease mobility. Soil vapor extraction works by flushing the soil pores with clean air and changing the contaminant distribution. Chemical oxidation destroys DNAPL mass and generates byproducts that can be measured. Thermal approaches obviously add heat to the subsurface and raising the temperature and driving volatilization and solubilization. Understanding, anticipating, and measuring these physical changes with an appropriate and robust monitoring program is key. Next slide shows an example of a thermal remediation project and discusses the suite of metrics that was used to measure progress. So on slide 17, this shows just a graphic of the Young Rainey Star Center in Florida, the former DOE facility, currently serves as an incubator for science and technology-related businesses. The principal contaminants of concern present in the soil and groundwater are or were trichloroethylene and toluene, which both occur as free product. For this remediation, the Department of Energy selected an innovative combination of steam injection and electrical resistance heating. And they also developed a unique performance-based contract, which placed a lot of responsibility on the vendor, but also allowed them a certain degree of flexibility and provided some incentives as well. The primary remediation objective was to remove DNAPLs from the subsurface and attain concentration-based cleanup goals for soil and groundwater. The metrics established by the DOE to assess performance were based on concentration targets, temperature targets, and hydraulic control. Groundwater concentration targets were established for each compound that basically equated to 1% of the compound's respective aqueous solubility. In addition, no groundwater sample could exceed the goal by more than 50%, and dissolved concentrations had to remain below these cleanup goals for at least 24 weeks following system shutdown. A minimum operating temperature had to be maintained at all times, 84 degrees Celsius in this case. And finally, hydraulic control had to be maintained in the remediation area to ensure or to address potential mobility. Progress of remediation was evaluated using several lines of evidence, including NAPL content in the extracted fluids, total petroleum hydrocarbon content in extracted water, the temperature distribution, as well as interim soil and groundwater samples. A more detailed description of this project appears in Appendix B of the ITRC document. Let's move to slide 18. This next slide provides an overview of the variety of methods being used to assess performance. It's based on a survey conducted by the Navy last year or a couple years ago. The complete report is available for download off the web. The survey was designed to document information on DNAPL treatment projects across the country. It posed several questions about DNAPL site conditions, source treatment technologies, as well as performance assessment to get an idea of the range of DNAPL sites out there and a sense of how successful they were. One of the questions dealt with the kinds of performance measures that were applied, and this slide shows a breakdown to the answers of that question. The survey respondents were asked to specify how they had evaluated the performance of the technology. They're given a list of options and asked to check those that applied. The most frequently chosen performance metric, as you can see, was monitoring of concentration of reductions in specific groundwater monitoring wells. Other frequently chosen metrics included total DNAPL mass removed and reduction in soil concentrations. As you can see, performance can be looked at in many ways using many different metrics. One thing the survey showed was that projects were sometimes perceived to be successful despite a lack of supporting data. And what appears successful to one person may indicate failure to another depending on the criteria they use to gauge success. That's one of the concerns we attempt to address in the ITRC document by suggesting that several measures of success be used to monitor progress. Slide 19. So like many problems in the environmental field, rarely is a silver bullet solution to a problem. A recent EPA expert panel report on DNAPL's states that no single metric by itself is likely to be adequate for assessing the performance and potential benefits of source depletion technologies. As you'll hear later on, every metric used to gauge success has its own set of limitations, but by monitoring several of these indicators or metrics, a clear picture can emerge that's drawn from multiple lines of evidence. All right, Dr. Castellaros will now discuss the selection of appropriate performance metrics, and some design considerations.
Thank you, Eric. I'm going to discuss the design of a performance monitoring program, and if there are any questions about that material, please feel free to ask them at the end of the section when we are going to take a short break for questions and answers. Slide 21. I must state right from the outset that putting together this document brought together professionals from many disciplines, and most of us had a lot of areas that we were in agreement with, and that one area especially was the importance of a conceptual site model. And very important in that is developing a performance monitoring program as a part of the conceptual site conceptual model. There's a lot of information that's used to develop the conceptual site model, and that can come from many sources such as historical records, site investigations, site sampling and analyses, computer simulations, and good old experience. Very important, though, to continuously update the conceptual site model so that in time it becomes less conceptual and more representative of the real and dynamic source zone conditions. Slide 22. Before we talk about the performance metrics, though, it's probably pretty helpful to review a few major concepts. And the first one we're going to do is partitioning of DNAPL within the subsurface. Next slide. That schematic on slide 23 shows how we can find DNAPL within the subsurface. It might be found as vapor within pore spaces or as sorbed onto the soil particles, dissolved within the soil moisture, or as pure DNAPL. Slide 24. Another definition we should probably review is what is saturation, a term that we use quite often in the document. Saturation is a measure of the volume of the DNAPL within a soil pore space that is expressed as a fraction of the total pore volume. So the saturation can vary from either 0%, which means no DNAPL, or 100%, which means it's fully saturated with DNAPL. Keep in mind that the total saturation is always 100. So that, in other words, if the saturation of DNAPL is less than 100, then the saturation of other phases must be greater than 0. Next slide. Retardation is another concept we should review. Retardation is a delay in the movement of a dissolved species. It's a delay in the travel of the solute when it's compared with the flow of the solvent. That delay, or retardation, can be caused by a few factors, one of them being sorption onto soil surfaces or sorption onto organic matter within the soil. Or it could be caused by partitioning within a non-aqueous phase, or a DNAPL. Slide 26. Very interesting phenomena was experienced in the early stages of groundwater cleanup, and that phenomena is called rebound. Sites that were discovered that had contaminated groundwater were often treated using a pump-and-treat approach. And then after that concentration was became lower over a period of time, the pumps were usually turned off. It was assumed at that point that the remediation effort was successful. So with the pumps turned off and some months of monitoring, the dissolved concentrations would often creep back up to the original pretreatment levels. We call that phenomena rebound. Slide 27. A couple of reasons that we experience the rebound is the non-equilibrium effect of DNAPL dissolution. Another reason could be the dilution effect of drawing clean groundwater from the pumping action that mixes with the contaminated groundwater and effectively lowers the concentration that is being pumped and treated. Rebound can also occur within the vado zone. So, for example, if soil vapor concentrations start to decrease when we start up an SVE system and then stabilize, they could rebound later when the system is turned off and allowed to come back to equilibrium. Rebound is one of the reasons that long-term monitoring of DNAPL sites is very important after active remediation has been completed. Slide 28. Now, slide 28 shows a list of several possible changes that could result from remediation. Now, this list is a list of possible changes, not a list of things that will definitely occur, but things that we need to keep in mind may occur. And it's important to keep that in mind because we are looking at performance assessment, and very often that's being determined by a metric that we compare before and after treatment. So we have to consider that some of these changes might occur from the treatment, from the remediation, and keep that in mind when we are designing that performance assessment program. We certainly don't want to be measuring the changes that occurred as opposed to the actual change in the concentrations of DNAPL so that we get an effective way of comparing before and after. Slide 29. Now, on slide 29, we see three groups of performance metrics. Now, in the performance assessment document, we have the performance metrics grouped this way into three categories. I'm going to discuss the benefits and the disadvantages of these metrics, but realize that something Eric mentioned earlier, the best approach is often to use several of them in an intelligent and well-balanced manner so that we use what is being called a converging lines of evidence approach. Let's take a look at the first column on the left. Slide 30. Estimating source treatment progress. There's three performance metrics there. That's changes in soil concentration, changes in dissolved concentration, and in soil vapor concentration. Let's talk in detail about the changes in soil concentration. Next slide. Slide 31. Now, to measure soil concentrations, we need to first collect samples from discrete locations, analyze them, and interpret the data, and then statistically average those results for the area that is between the sampling points. Now, this table tends to exemplify some of the limitations in this approach. First of all, selecting the sampling points that we are using to locate bean apple can often lead to a high likelihood of error. Now, if we look at this table, it's a statistical table based on a two-dimensional model, and it's showing the results of random sampling that is required in order to find a source when the ratio of the source to the target is either 10, 100, or 1,000. And on the left side, we see what probability of detection we desire in order to achieve that level. We look over to the right and see how many samples are required. So for an example, if my source is about 1/100th of the area of the target, we've got 90% probability would need about 230 random samples in order to find that source. Very high number, and it kind of exemplifies how difficult it can often be for us to find bean apple within the subsurface by using random sampling locations and soil concentration data. Slide 32. Other limitations include losing bean apple volume due to evaporation. Also, if we mix soil within the vertical profile, our results will often lead to some error. Next, if bean apple moves during the remediation, these changes in the soil concentration are going to be misunderstood. We're going to think that that's due to the remediation effort, when in fact it's simply due to the fact that the bean apple moved during the time we started and ended the remediation. Finally, the size of the sample that you require in order to measure the presence of bean apple might be larger than the amount that you actually collected, and that can lead to error in your results. Several limitations there. Next slide, we're going to talk about the limitations in using dissolved concentrations as a performance metric. Measuring dissolved concentrations has some limitations, and you see on the list there a couple of them. The applicability and use, the multi-level sampling approach, we'll talk about that in a moment, the well design and installation, purging, passive diffusion bag samplers, and finally, I'll review the limitations in these. For the most part, we're going to talk about the applicability and use and limitations. Slide 34. Groundwater quality is often used to assess performance of many bean apple remediation projects. Groundwater monitoring techniques are very well known and can be found in the literature. But one of the problems that we find is that the groundwater levels can be highly variable. An important factor is the effect of bean apple dissolution rate, solubility limits, and groundwater flow rates, which often cause these changes in groundwater levels. A final consideration is something we mentioned earlier, the rebound effect. Any DNAPL that remains within the subsurface can dissolve back into the groundwater, and that will likely return the groundwater concentrations back to the original levels. That makes our job very difficult in using dissolved concentrations as a performance metric. Slide 35. Decreases in soil vapor concentration. DNAPLs that are volatile can be detected in the soil vapor that is extracted from the vado zone. We can measure those concentrations of DNAPL constituents during an SVE remediation process. And in that way, we can determine the total DNAPL that is removed from the subsurface. Now, the difficulty in using the soil vapor concentration data as a performance metric is that you need to continuously measure the soil gas flow rate and continuously measure the contaminant concentration within the soil gas so that you can measure this mass. Now, because different components of the DNAPL may have different volatilization rates, making that estimate of DNAPL mass can become complicated. Next slide. We're now going to look at the second column, source mass reduction, which has three categories within it: mass extracted, mass destroyed in situ, and then the mass remaining. Slide 37. To determine the fraction of DNAPL mass reduction can be a difficult calculation, and that's because of the difficulty that we have in measuring the contaminant mass. The mass of DNAPL that is brought to the surface, the amount that's extracted, we can measure that fairly easily. But the problem is in measuring the DNAPL mass remaining within the subsurface. That is the difficulty. Slide 38. Mass reduction can be estimated for some of the remediation techniques that destroy DNAPL in situ, and it can be done by determining the concentration of indicators. So, for example, isotopes of carbon have been used as an indicator of oxidation of chlorinated ethenes. A chlorinated solvent mixture that is undergoing oxidation becomes enriched in C13 over time, so the ratio of C12 to C13 can be monitored and used to gauge the effectiveness of the oxidation process. Chloride isotopes can also be used as an indicator parameter, and it's been suggested recently. The concept is very similar to that for carbon isotopes. However, to my knowledge, that approach has not yet been developed and used in the field. Slide 39. Soil samples analyzed in order to quantify the contaminant mass. There are a number of techniques that are used to collect soil samples for chemical analysis from the DNAPL source area, and each of those has a benefit and a limitation. Contaminant mass remaining is typically calculated by measuring the contaminant concentration and then multiplying by the volume and density of the media. Potential problems with quantifying contaminant mass using soil concentration data include all of those difficulties we mentioned earlier when we were discussing attempts to quantify the average contaminant concentrations. Now, on this slide, we see two methods. The next slide is going to discuss the second of the two, partitioning interwell tracer testing, or a PIT test. Slide 40. A PIT consists of injecting a suite of tracers, conservative and partitioning tracers, into one or more wells, and then producing those tracers from one or more nearby extraction wells. After the tracer is injected, typically potable water or air is used to drive the tracers across a zone of interest. Conservative tracers will pass through unhindered, while partitioning tracers will become retarded by interacting with the DNAPL. The tracer response is monitored at the extraction well, and it's used to estimate the average DNAPL saturation and also the swept pore volume of the subsurface. It can also then be used to calculate the total volume of DNAPL within the subsurface. The limitations of this approach are that it's relatively new and innovative, And that means that there's a limited wealth of experience in using that in the field. Media permeability can have an effect on the sweep efficiency of the tracers. So, in other words, as the tracers move through the subsurface, they'll tend to move through the more permeable zones, and less tracer will move through the lower permeable zones. So you might have a difference in flow rates that are maybe 10 times higher in a permeable layer than in a lower permeable layer. There are ways of countering that. That is, there are ways of improving what is called the sweep efficiency by using things like foam and viscosifiers to get a better tip test result. Slide 41. This slide shows some laboratory data as an example of the pit theory. A conservative tracer, in this case IPA, is being compared to two partitioning tracers, 2-methyl-2-pentanol and pentanol. Now, if you look at this results on the slide, we see that the tracer results give a saturation of about 17.4 and 17.5% as compared to a gravimetric result of 17.5%. So it works very well in the laboratory, and it's being done in the field as well. For some data and some more background information, the ITRC performance assessment document has some additional references that you can use to learn more about this approach called the PIP. Slide 42. The final category of performance metrics, the last column, are those used to estimate the impact of Dean Apple source treatment. There are three groups in this category: decreases in toxicity, decrease in mobility, and decrease in plume loading. First, decrease in toxicity, slide 43. An indirect measure of performance is measuring the impact of the Dean Apple treatment. This is especially applicable for sites that contain mixtures, where removing certain target compounds from the mixture will reduce the overall toxicity or perhaps the overall mobility, and it might be a more appropriate measure of success. Toxicity, however, is not easily measured, and in addition, there may be questions about verifying long-term stability of this observed toxicity reduction. So it requires a long-term testing and enough fundamental understanding so that predicting the long-term effects will be done with certainty. Next slide. Mitigating the further spread of the source by decreasing the Dean Apple mobility is often another cited objective of Dean Apple source remediation. So the goal in this case is to deplete the source sufficiently to reduce Dean Apple to a residual saturation level so that it's relatively stable. It should be noted that reaching residual saturation does not always equate with reaching a point of immobility. Immobilized Dean Apple that's held in place by a balance of dynamic forces could be upset by changes in groundwater flow, tidal effects, earth pressure, and ground vibration. Mobility changes are usually measured by direct observation. So if we see product in some of the wells, it's usually an indirect measure that we have mobility of Dean Apple mobility. Another way might be to examine soil cores or even measure using a pit test. Slide 45. Changes in plume loading. Now, the goals of removing mass from a source zone include reducing risk of contaminant migration, reducing plume longevity, reducing the overall remediation cost, accelerating natural attenuation, and speeding transition to a more passive technology. And mass flux is often the most meaningful metric in assessing the progress towards these goals. Next slide. Using plume load as a measure of success, shutting down the remedial system could be considered when mass release rate from the source to the groundwater, or in other words, mass flux, falls below the assimilative capacity or the natural attenuation capacity of the aquifer. Natural attenuation capacity can be defined for groundwater systems as a measure of its ability to lower groundwater concentrations along the aquifer flow paths. The natural attenuation capacity of groundwater systems depends on hydrologic and biological factors, and it can be assessed using quantitative models. Mass flux defined here is the rate at which solute mass in the groundwater plume crosses a spatial plane at a right angle to the direction of the groundwater flow. This figure illustrates the complexity of mass flux within a heterogeneous subsurface and the value of using mass flux as a metric in source remediation. How is mass flux measured? Slide 47. Mass flux can be measured along one or more planes perpendicular to the flow direction. Measurements that are near the source zone will provide an estimate of source strength. Most of the methods that are discussed in the ITRC document allow mass flux measurements to be done down gradient, and that provides valuable data on the rate of attenuation and the plume responses to source treatment. Four methods are available to measure mass flux. One, analyzing samples recovered during continuous groundwater extraction, measuring contaminant concentrations and groundwater velocity during short-term pump tests. Three, measuring contaminant concentrations at multiple locations across a transect using, say, multi-level samplers so that you can get a geostatistical average concentration. And finally, measuring contaminant concentrations and groundwater velocities at multiple locations using passive borehole flux meters. These are discussed in the document. These approaches to mass flux estimating are relatively new, particularly using passive flux meters and pump tests. However, development and testing is ongoing, and later, Ryan Wymore will discuss a mass flux-based performance study that was conducted that shows considerable promise. We are ready for some questions and answers.
Thank you. This is Juliana. For those of you who are on our phone line, you need to unmute your phone. If you used our system, it was *7 to unmute. For the simulcast audience, please use the question mark button at the top of your screen to type in a question. For our phone audience, please state your name and location as you ask your question. Do we have any questions? And again, if
Hello?
Yes.
I have a question. On the slide, I can't remember what number, he was going over the ratios or the number of samples. The you took the ratio of the A over AS over A sub T and that source over target, and that ratio, then you could tell how many samples you needed. I didn't understand what was target. Was A sub T and A sub T, or A sub S and A sub T? Was that the area of the source versus the area of what? What's the target?
Sure. Area, let me back up and make sure that that's clear. It's area of the site, not source.
Okay.
If I said source, I apologize.
Oh.
It should be area of the site versus area of the target. So
target.
We have to think of the target as being the DNAPL location.
Okay.
What we're trying to show in that table is how hard it is to find the DNAPL, which is called the target in this table. So if the site is about 100 times larger than the DNAPL, now, of course, we don't always know where the DNAPL is in the real world, but this is an example to show how hard it is to find. If the site is about 100 times greater in terms of planar area than the target, and we want to find it with a probability of, say, 90%, it would require about 230 samples to find.
Okay. Thanks for clarifying that. You had said source. And so I thought that the source was the DNAPL, and the target was, like, the whole site. So I had them exactly mixed up from that.
Okay. Then I completely understand your question. Sorry about that.
This is Julianne. I have a simulcast question from Nancy Saka of the Oregon DEQ. What would be considered sufficient long-term monitoring to measure rebound effects?
Hello?
Yes.
Can you repeat, Juliana?
Sorry about that. What would be considered sufficient long-term monitoring to measure rebound effects?
Well, I think some of the people on the phone that are more regulators than myself, I'm an academic myself, but in my experience, each state tends to have different requirements, and sometimes in my consulting experience, meeting with a regulator may necessitate changing that requirement slightly, but typically I've seen 1 to 2 years required by regulators for monitoring. But perhaps some folks on the phone can talk about their experience in what's required at different states.
Well, this is Eric. I came back late. Sorry. In New York State, you know, we don't have a specific guidance on that, but my experience, like 5 quarters of groundwater monitoring, it depends on what your technology and experience with the site is as well. But, you know, a full year of quarterly monitoring at least. And it'll depend on the technology, too.
Thank you, Eric. Do we have additional questions?
Yes, this is Dennis Jackson from Savannah River National Lab. I'm curious as to, in your mass flux measurements, how do you keep that process from inheriting the limitations of your monitoring systems, i.e. collecting soil cores or groundwater concentrations via multi-well boreholes and stuff like that? Seems like you're adding to the uncertainty there process.
Ryan, do you think you might want to respond to that?
Well, I would say that because they do basically all involve some form of groundwater sampling, that some of the uncertainty is going to remain. But what you do is, for a lot of those methods, they integrate the results over time. So the continuous groundwater extraction and the integrated pump test involve continuous pumping of large volumes of water so that you can sort of erase the uncertainties associated with, you know, purging a well under low flow conditions for, you know, maybe 30 minutes or whatever it is, and collecting sort of a sample at a point in time. The borehole flux meters do the same thing because they're installed in a well, and based on absorbance of contaminants to the flux meters, as well as tracers that are loaded onto the flux meters that bleed off as groundwater flows past, they give you an idea of how much contaminant loading essentially is present in the water that's passed through the meter. And those are in place for days or weeks at a time, so you get an integrated result rather than a point result. In terms of, you know, uncertainties, you still obviously have uncertainties, like for the flux meters, for example. They still have the uncertainties associated with groundwater wells and screens and stuff like that. And the pump tests also, the pumping methods, have some of those same uncertainties, so that you don't completely get rid of them. But the idea is, I think, to get, you know, more of an integrated sample rather than a point sample in time.
And I think one of the points that you're making, maybe it didn't come out as strongly, though, is that you're not pumping, so you're not introducing that uncertainty due to dilution of clean groundwater with dirty groundwater, which might change concentrations.
Right, yeah, for the flux meters, that's true.
Right.
Thank you. This is Juliana. I have another simulcast question. Shanna Thompson at ERM in Atlanta, Georgia asked, do you believe multiple level sampling can be accomplished using PDBs at varying depths, and I'm polyethylene diffusion bag samplers?
Yeah, this is Ryan. I would say it could be done that way. Typically, the limitations with multi-level sampling have to do with the formation and the way that you complete the wells that you install the samplers into. There are some formations, like fractured rock formations, that you can complete as open holes, And, for example, you can put a series of PDBs or any other kind of a passive sampler in the borehole, but then you have uncertainties associated with vertical flow, flow entering the borehole from one horizon and moving upwards or downwards to another horizon, and you can get an integrated sample. Some of the other multi-level sampling systems try to overcome that by sealing the borehole with either flexible liners or by actually having multiple completions within a well. So I would say it depends on what the aquifer is as to how well that would work and how representative it would be.
Thank you. Do we have additional questions from our phone audience?
Yeah, hi. Question, Mary Tiernan, Region 5, Chicago, EPA.
Hi.
Hi. Slide 41, you talked about the pit tracer response.
Yes, okay.
Could you talk a little bit more about that and what the significance is of the 17%?
Sure. This slide in particular is showing laboratory results. So this is a one-dimensional flow in a column that was contaminated with a Dean apple. And tracers are injected at one end of the column and allowed to flow through the column under a forced gradient and collected at the other end of the column. And then the concentrations that are measured on the effluent are what you're seeing plotted there. Now, they were injected at the same time, so if there was no napple in that soil, they should all show the same peak.
I'm trying to work this out.
But because those peaks get separated, we can deduce that there's something causing it, a retardation effect, which is due to the Dean apple. And more than that, you can actually integrate and use data from that result to determine how much Dean apple is in the soil column. So using these tracer results, just using the concentrations, the two numbers you see, 17.4 and 17.5, are measurements of Dean apple using just the tracer data and then gravimetrically measuring, in other words, taking the soil and actually measuring it before and after, gives a value of 17.5. So what we're showing here is how accurate the tracer test can be. Now, again, this is a one-dimensional flow in a laboratory where we had control over the situation. In the field, it can also be done, though, and it's being done in the field. There's not an extensive wealth of knowledge, but there are some that are published already on tracer tests in the field.
This is Juliana. I have a perhaps related question from Mr. Moran in the Vermont DEC. Why do you use IPA as a conservative tracer? Isn't it a co-solvent?
Oh, it certainly could be. There's other conservative tracers that could be used. Even some salts could be used. For example, I've used bromide before as a conservative tracer as well. Essentially, the property of a conservative tracer would be that we can actually measure it, easily, and that it doesn't partition to the suspected Dean apple. We also don't like it to partition very much to the soil or to any of the organic matter. So in this particular laboratory experiment, isopropyl alcohol was used. I've seen ethyl alcohol used in the field, which was fun to use. It was an interesting tracer to use there at Hill Air Force Base. But there are certainly others that are non-partitioning, that are conservative tracers that could be used. And the partitioning tracers as well, there's lots of other possible partitioning tracers to use. And some of the papers that are referenced in the ITRC's performance assessment document talk a lot more about how to select the tracers and what properties to look for in good tracers.
Do we have additional questions from our phone line audience?
Yeah, this is Ryan, and just adding to what Konstantinos just said, another aspect of that question may be whether the what we're calling the conservative tracer can be degraded or otherwise attenuated besides just retardation. And I think the answer is that the time scale of these tests is such that you don't have to worry about degradation. most of the time. I mean, if you're conducting a test that runs over many days, then you would want something like bromide that's not biodegradable.
That's true. Usually these tracer tests in the field are done they're done at short duration tests, and it's not a major concern to worry about as far as a degradation of any of them within the subsurface.
Right.
Thank you. I have a simulcast question from Ellen Moyer at Green Environmental. With the pit analysis, how do you tell the difference between partitioning into DNAPL versus partitioning into TOC?
Well, that's a good question. And typically what's done is samples of the soil from the site are taken to the laboratory before doing the testing in the field. And those samples are taken to the lab, and any partitioning to the soil particles or to any organic matter in the soil particles is measured beforehand. And so that way it can be taken into account when the test is actually done. We can look at the results and determine what percentage of the retardation is due to partitioning onto organic matter or soil particles versus how much is due to the NAPL itself. Now, the shapes of the curves, when you do get experience with using tracers, what you will notice is that the shapes of the curves tend to also reflect the type of retardation. In other words, a retardation that's due to sorption onto the soil particles will tend to give you one type of retardation response, if I can call it that, versus a NAPL, which is usually in one zone as opposed to evenly spread throughout. So you do actually start seeing different shapes due to that. You also, I might add, see different shapes when you have zones of high hydraulic conductivity. So one of the things we didn't really stress in the presentation today is that the tracer can actually show you that there's a layer of high permeability. Some people call that a thief zone, but when you do have those thin layers that are very high in hydraulic conductivity, we get concerned because we're pumping in remediation fluids, whether it's a bioremediation fluid or an oxidant or surfactant or something, and we're spending a lot of money cleaning out one thin layer as opposed to the rest of the... So it's a useful thing to find out, and the tracer test will tell you that.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank our instructors for this question and answer period. I'm going to wrap up and we'll move into the second half. But if you do have additional questions, we will have another question and answer break at the end of today's training. You're welcome to make yourself a note so that you remember to ask a question. If you have taken your phones off mute, please mute your phones. If you're sharing the speakerphone, have someone check to be sure that phone is muted. It is *6 to mute if you're using our system. And I'll remind you again, it is *7 to unmute during the next question and answer period. If you'll turn to slide 49, I'm going to turn today's presentations over to Ryan Wymore of CVM. Ryan?
Thanks, Juliana. We're going to talk about in this next section of the training aspects of performance monitoring as it relates to specific remediation technologies. I just want to emphasize that these are going to be general recommendations, not to be necessarily universally applied, but of course considered at each site-specific monitoring program. Moving to slide 50. Just by way of overview of this section, we're going to provide an overview of different categories of DNAPL remediation technologies, conventional technologies, in-situ thermal treatments, surfactant co-solvent flushing, chemical oxidation, and enhanced bioremediation. For each one of these, I'll provide a short technology description and then an overview of performance monitoring that's applicable to that technology in terms of both the effectiveness performance monitoring and efficiency performance monitoring tools. Slide 51, just to reemphasize what we're calling those definitions, we've talked about two types of performance monitoring, remedial effectiveness and system efficiency. When we talk about effectiveness monitoring, we're comparing the before and after states of various performance metrics, for example, soil concentrations or groundwater concentrations. For system efficiency monitoring, we're talking about operational parameters that are used to optimize the remedial process. For example, injection or extraction flow rate, temperature, pressure, etc. The frequency of both of these types of monitoring depends on the technology that's being applied. Slide 52. The first category of technologies we've sort of lumped together and called conventional remedies. The first one of these is simple DNAPL recovery. In a situation where mobile free-flowing DNAPL is encountered at a site and can be simply pumped or baled out of wells. The next one, soil vapor extraction, involves creating a subsurface vacuum, pulling volatile contaminants to wells that are screened in the vado zone, and removing contaminants in the vapor phase. Air sparging involves injection of air into the saturated zone, and the technology relies on stripping of volatile contaminants from the groundwater. Biosparging is a variation that creates conditions favorable for aerobic biodegradation of contaminants. For all of these conventional remedies, typically the key monitoring parameter is contaminant mass removed. So in other words, you simply measure how much contaminant you remove from the ground and monitor performance using that metric. Slide 53. In-situ thermal technologies. There are several variations or ways to implement this technology. All of them involve essentially using heat to force a phase change of the contaminant from liquid to vapor, where it's then extracted and brought to the subsurface and separated. The heat is generated either by injected steam, by electricity that flows between electrodes, or by heat conduction between thermal wells. Steam-enhanced extraction, as you might imagine, involves generating steam at the surface, injecting the steam into the subsurface, and for this technology, the contaminants physically move with a steam front to extraction wells. For electrical resistance heating, this technology involves inputting electricity from a municipal power source into the subsurface using electrodes. The flow of electricity between the electrodes resistively heats the subsurface to the boiling point of contaminants and water. The next one is conductive heating or in-situ thermal destruction. This also inputs electricity into the subsurface, but it does so with heater or thermal wells. Heat flows through the soil from the thermal wells primarily by thermal conduction. Again, in terms of performance assessment, similar remedial effectiveness and efficiency parameters are used for all of these technologies. So for efficiency parameters, which again are the ones that are used to optimize the actual operation of the system, things that you might look at are subsurface temperature, vacuum, pressure, and power consumption. In terms of effectiveness, the performance metrics are similar to other technologies. You look at the contaminant mass that you recover both in the vapor and in the aqueous phases. You can look at changes in soil concentration, say before and after you operate the remedy, or changes in groundwater concentration. Slide 54. Now we're going to go through briefly a case study of an electrical resistance heating pilot test that was conducted at the Department of Energy Paducah Gaseous Diffusion Plant back in 2003 for remediation of TCE DNAPL. Just by way of overview, the hydrogeology at the site, there is groundwater encountered at about 50 feet below ground. Silt and sand overlying soils extend down to just below the water table at about 56 feet below ground. And then from there, down to 100 feet is the regional gravel aquifer, down again from 56 to 100 feet. The contaminant distribution is such that TCE is present as a residual DNAPL throughout the unsaturated zone and also the saturated zone, and the source area covers about 200,000 square feet. DNAPL is believed to be present as pools in some areas. The estimated mass of about 1 million pounds of TCE was released at this site, and the suspected source was near an above-ground storage tank near building C-400, which is shown on the slide. The objectives of the pilot test was to demonstrate the implementability and the cost effectiveness of the technology for both the vado zone and the saturated zone. Beforehand, performance metrics were set up to monitor the performance of the project. These included subsurface temperature and soil concentration and groundwater concentration. Among other things, those are the three that we're going to look at here today. In terms of the criteria, the goal of the pilot test was to achieve a 75% reduction in average soil concentration in the vado zone and to reduce the average DCE concentration to below 1% of the aqueous solubility, which is that 1% goal essentially was 11 milligrams per liter in groundwater. Moving to the next slide, slide 55. This shows a picture of the pilot test area. And you can see some of the equipment involved for electrical resistance heating. There's a power control unit, electrodes, steam condenser, water cooling tower, vacuum blower, and activated carbon for treatment of the vapor that's extracted. Now, in terms of the operation of the pilot test, there were six electrodes installed in an area of about 30 feet in diameter. Treatment was continued for 175 days of active heating, and this heating resulted in a heated area that was about 43 feet in diameter, so it obviously extended beyond where the electrodes were installed. But if you remember the overall contaminated area, the estimate of the source area, this is much smaller than that. So this was just, again, a pilot test to see how this technology would work. Another challenge for this project was that the system had to be constructed and operated without negatively affecting adjacent utilities and operations that were ongoing at the site. Slide 56, we're going to briefly look at a little bit of data from the pilot test. This is a temperature profile versus depth over time from the pilot test. So this would be an example of a system efficiency performance metric. This shows the increase in subsurface temperature over time at depth. So each colored line is the temperature profile with depth at different points in time during the pilot test. And just for reference, the green line represents the boiling point of TCE at depth, and the blue line represents the boiling point of water at depth. So from a quick look at this chart, you can see that the subsurface temperatures reach the boiling point of TCE following about 6 weeks of operation. Slide 57. This is an example of using before and after soil concentrations as a performance metric, and this would fall under the category of effectiveness, so how well did the technology actually clean up the subsurface. The average TCE concentrations in soil are shown for before the pilot test in the red line and afterwards in the blue line. And the average soil concentrations decreased by about 98% from 125 milligrams per kilogram beforehand to about 2.5 milligrams per kilogram afterwards. So the performance metric, or the criteria for soil concentrations, was met. Slide 58 shows the groundwater results. These charts were generated from data that were collected from two multi-level monitoring wells located inside the treatment area that were sampled at six discrete depth intervals. So the initial concentrations at these wells, I know it's sort of hard to see on the slide, were between 500 and 1,000 milligrams per liter of TCE. And the final concentrations were between 1 and 10 milligrams per liter, which is an average reduction of about 99%, and which did meet the goal of getting below 11. Now it's important to note that these final concentrations are far above MCLs, but these goals were realistic for the project, considering that in general, thermal technologies are not appropriate for getting all the way to MCLs, and this goes back to what Eric had talked about earlier, that there's no silver bullet for these kind of sites. And also considering that, again, this pilot test was conducted in a small area located right in the center of a really big DNAPL source zone. Now, I do want to point out that there are other thermal remediation projects discussed in the appendix of the performance assessment document. Moving on to slide 59, the next technology we're going to discuss is monitoring for surfactant co-solvent flushing. So by way of a description of the technology, surfactants are simply compounds that alter the properties of organic water interfaces. They can solubilize and or mobilize zones containing DNAPL. Co-solvents are similar to surfactants in that they alter the properties of solution interfaces, and examples of co-solvents include alcohols that we've actually talked about a little bit earlier, methanol, ethanol, and isopropanol. As a remediation technology, surfactant co-solvent flushing is a removal technology as opposed to a destructive technology. It involves injection and subsequent extraction of surfactants and other co-solvents. It's described further in an ITRC DNAPL team document. We provide the link at the end of the training. In terms of performance monitoring, you can look at efficiency parameters such as the injection and or extraction flow rates, the surfactant co-solvent injection concentration, water levels in the wells to assess hydraulic capture, and also potentially mounding during injection. In terms of effectiveness, as you might guess, you can look at the contaminant concentrations in the water that's being pumped out. You can look at the NAPL saturation before and after treatment, perhaps using a pit test. And you can also look at visual changes in extracted fluids, which is sort of a qualitative measure that's unique to this technology. We'll go through a quick example of a surfactant flushing application in the next few slides. So moving to slide 60. This is a picture of a surfactant co-solvent flushing demonstration project at Hill Air Force Base, operable Unit 2. Contamination at the site is primarily TCE DNAPL in the source area, with a large plume extending several hundreds of feet down gradient. In terms of performance assessment, we looked at groundwater concentrations, mass flux, and then visual observation of the extracted fluids. Slide 61. This shows some of the design of the flux-based performance study, which, as Konstantinos mentioned, this was one of the early studies of flux measurement. So in terms of how this was done, at this site there's a geologic saddle, so to speak, that's immediately down gradient of the source that forms sort of a spillway for contaminated groundwater to move from the source into the down gradient part of the plume. So at this site, the measurements were taken right at that location. And there were two flux techniques that were employed to compare the results: passive flux meters and the integrated pumping technique. So the first flux measurement pre-treatment was conducted in June of 2002, and then in July was the surfactant co-solvent flood. And then a year later, in June 2003, was the second flux measurement, the post-treatment measurement. Slide 62 shows the results. You can see that there was general agreement between the two flux measurement techniques. Based on the passive flux meters, there was about a 90% reduction in flux. Based on the integral pumping technique, about 67 to 75% reduction. And then I do want to point out that using only the raw concentration data, so in other words, not accounting for the differences in discharge rates, and basically not converting the concentrations into mass fluxes, that resulted in an 88% reduction in the average dissolved concentration. So it was in the ballpark, or actually in between, the reduction in flux using the two methods. Slide 63, this shows extracted fluid visual changes, which again is sort of unique to a surfactant flushing operation. Basically, this can be used to qualitatively assess the performance of the technology. You collect samples of the actual fluids that you're pumping out over time. The dark samples in early time indicate, qualitatively at least, that you're getting high contaminant concentrations being removed. So the dark colors in early times then progress to light colors at later times. That indicates the approach to a limiting return on investment for continuing the flushing operation. So again, this is sort of a qualitative way, but a quick way to tell how this technology is performing and when you might be approaching a point where you should consider stopping the technology and maybe moving on to something else. Slide 64. Chemical oxidation. Just as a quick overview, this technology involves the injection of oxidants directly into the source zone. The oxidants then create free radicals that react with contaminants, and then chemical bonds are broken and innocuous substances are produced. So for chlorinated solvents, this is carbon dioxide, water, and chloride, or the ultimate end products. For this technology, the oxidants are normally injected and not extracted, but recirculation can be used in some cases. Examples of common oxidants include permanganate, hydrogen peroxide, and ozone, and also, a little bit more recently, persulfate. The design has to consider the proper oxidant concentration and dose, which are based on the aquifer matrix and also the contaminants that are present. And then, of course, there's the variables of the horizontal and vertical spacing of the injections, which are largely determined by the geology of the site. In terms of performance monitoring, we can look at efficiency parameters such as the rate of injection, the oxidant concentration, and also the pressure in the injection wells or the injection points. In terms of effectiveness, it's similar to the other technologies where you look at the contaminant concentrations in soil and groundwater, maybe before and after. You can also look at water quality parameters such as pH and ORP and also chloride to assess the performance of this technology. Slide 65. Some considerations that are unique to chemical oxidation as compared to the technologies we have discussed already is that this is a destructive technology. So you don't have the ability to measure or track the extracted contaminant mass over time. So in order to document the effectiveness of the treatment, you have to have before and after contaminant delineation. Sampling and analysis of the soil and the groundwater is also required to assess the contaminant mass destruction. You have to allow sufficient time to evaluate conditions after the site reaches a new post-treatment equilibrium, which is really important with chemical oxidation, especially as rebound has been noted to occur at sites that were previously thought to be remediated. And the key for chemical oxidation is that before you do this rebound sampling, the oxidant has to be consumed. Otherwise, you haven't really reached the post-treatment state at the site yet. So again, just to emphasize, the post-treatment rebound in dissolved contaminants can be observed due to desorption and NAPL dissolution that occur following the consumption of the oxidant. And the ITRC had an active in-situ chemical oxidation team, and there's actually been a recent update to a document that they wrote a few years ago, and I think there's even a training that is being offered that's a training on the updated document. Slide 66. This is a case study of a chemical oxidation project that used FENS reagent, and at this site the performance metric was changes in groundwater concentrations. So by way of background, Site 11 is an old county landfill located on Naval Submarine Base in Kings Bay, Georgia. It had contamination that was total chlorinated compounds of greater than 9,000 micrograms per liter within the source area of the landfill. A pump and treat system was installed to address the contaminant plume. So in terms of remediation activities in 1998, the source area remediation using FENS reagent was initiated, and the cleanup goal was 100 micrograms per liter for total chlorinateds. There were two injections that were performed, along with 13 months of performance monitoring. In terms of the parameters of performance monitoring, they looked at daily groundwater monitoring and off-gas analysis during the injections. The parameters that were measured in the field included pH, peroxide, chloride, iron, alkalinity, and carbon dioxide. After the 13 months, concentrations dropped to below 60 micrograms per liter, which was an average reduction of 94% across the site. And based on these results, the pump and treat system was shut down to allow natural attenuation to complete the restoration. Slide 67. The last technology we're going to talk about is enhanced bioremediation. This involves the injection of an electron donor, or a carbon source, directly into a source area to stimulate reductive dechlorination. You know, this process is well understood and described elsewhere in several ITRC, EPA, and other guidance documents, and we have the link to some of those at the end of the training. Just for a refresher, the pathway of reductive dechlorination is shown on this slide. It basically involves a sequential replacement of chlorine atoms with hydrogen atoms until ethene is produced, which is an innocuous end product. This technology or this process occurs most efficiently under methanogenic conditions, which are strongly reducing redox conditions. And it requires an adequate and well-distributed supply of electron donor. It has been shown to be effective for remediation of dissolved phase plumes for several years now, and recently has been shown to be effective in DNAPL source areas because it enhances the bioavailability of contaminants. In terms of performance monitoring, if I didn't explicitly mention it before, it's like chemical oxidation because the degradation reactions occur in the aqueous phase. There is not a direct destruction of the DNAPL phase. This technology and chemical oxidation rely on accelerating the rate at which contaminants are transferred from the non-aqueous phase to the aqueous phase where they're degraded. So because of that, for bioremediation, the effectiveness monitoring is almost always changes in groundwater concentrations. And I refer to Table 5.4 in the performance assessment document. Examples of groundwater parameters include, obviously, the contaminants and also their reductive daughter products, but also you can look at redox-sensitive parameters, such as ORP and ferrous iron and nitrate and methane and sulfate, to get an idea of what the redox state of the aquifer is. There are, somewhat more recently, some innovative monitoring tools that include measuring the changes in stable carbon isotope signatures, and also there have been some major advances recently in characterization tools that are available for looking at the microbial community. Slide 68. This is an example, enhanced source area bioremediation project, the full case study of which is provided in the appendix of the document. And like I mentioned before, for this site, the performance metric was changes in groundwater concentration. In terms of site background, there was industrial wastewater that included chlorinated solvents, low-level radioactive waste, and sanitary sewage that were injected directly into the Snake River Plain aquifer from the late 1950s to 1972 at Test Area North, which is at the Idaho National Laboratory. This has resulted in a nearly 2-mile-long TCE plume, and a residual source area is present that's about 100 feet in diameter with sludge concentration that's up to 3% TCE, and that's shown on the right of the slide. The contaminated aquifer is about 200 to 400 feet deep, and it's a fractured basalt system. So back in 1999, a full-scale field evaluation of bioremediation was started by injecting directly into the former injection well. A ROD amendment was signed in 2001 that selected bioremediation to replace pump and treat, and today the operations of bioremediation are ongoing. Initially, for the first 6 years or so at this site, the electron donor that was used was sodium lactate and has since been switched to whey powder. Slide 69. This is an example of using changes in groundwater concentrations to monitor the performance of the technology. At this site, the remedial action objectives are to achieve MCLs within 100 years. This slide shows a plan view of the source area of the TAN site that showed pre-lactate TCE contours on the top and then the contours after 21 months of lactate injections. These contours are generated from groundwater sampling that's conducted at 17 locations. You can see the pre-lactate injection concentrations were a few milligrams per liter right around the former injection well. And after the 21 months, concentrations have been reduced below detection in several wells at the point in time shown on this slide because of the injection of lactate. Now, it's important to note that the operations are still needed at this site, and they're in fact still ongoing, because of the presence of the residual source, that sludge material with the up to 3% TCE in it, that is trapped in the aquifer surrounding the injection well. At this point, a long-term cessation in electron donor additions would result in the eventual rebound of TCE concentrations in groundwater because the source is still there. Slide 70. This shows sort of another manifestation of using groundwater concentrations to monitor performance. This shows the changes in groundwater concentration over time of TCE and the degradation products. And the point of this slide is to show that significant ethene production, which is the dark blue data series, indicates that the process is being driven to completion and that the disappearance of TCE isn't the result of a physical displacement or some other process. This shows that degradation is actually occurring. So it's another way that you can look at parameters besides just the parent contaminant to assess performance. Slide 71. One of the important results from the Testaria North bioremediation project was the observation of enhanced mass transfer from the residual source. So what this refers to is the fact that injection of electron donor along with other mechanisms such as the actual degradation of contaminants themselves can increase the rate at which contaminants essentially dissolve into groundwater from a DNAPL or from a separate phase source. This chart shows the chlorinated ethane concentrations from one of the monitoring wells at that site. You'll note the near 21-fold increase in TCE concentration at the beginning, from January to March of 1999. This increase coincided exactly with the arrival of high concentrations of lactate at the well. So the TCE migration was somehow facilitated by the lactate. Degradation of TCE to cis-TCE indicated that this TCE was bioavailable, and then by the next injection, which is the second peak, the TCE was nearly all degraded to cis-TCE by the time it arrived at the well. So this enhanced mass transfer phenomenon caused by bioremediation has now been documented in several laboratory studies and is being observed more and more at pilot and field scale sites, so much so that in 2004, ITRC formed a team that's called the Bioremediation of DNAPLs team to further look into this, and that team's been ongoing now for a year or two and has actually produced an overview document of how this process can work in source zones that have chlorinated ethene DNAPLs. So with that, I will turn it back over to Eric for some finishing thoughts on regulatory and stakeholder concerns.
All right. Thank you, Ryan. All right. We're almost done, folks. I'd like to finish up, as you said, with a few slides on health and safety, regulatory concerns, and public stakeholder involvement. I'll turn to slide 73. Health and safety of site workers and in the surrounding community is obviously a major concern of regulators and stakeholders, every remedial project. Health and safety measures for site workers are typically addressed in the site health and safety plan, including the use of personal protection equipment, respirators and all that, working around excavators and air monitoring. In addition, you'll often see hazards associated with sampling and monitoring activities addressed in the health and safety plan, like procedures for properly opening a well cap or screening and screening that well for built-up gases, or wearing latex gloves when handling contaminated soil samples. As far as performance assessment goes, there are very few hazards associated specifically with performance monitoring and normal precautions that you take while sampling or working near operating remedial system equipment applied to performance monitoring. Two specific concerns I'd like to highlight when collecting performance data in and around a DNAPL site are sampling soil and groundwater within the targeted treatment zone and being aware of electrical hazards. During in-situ thermal treatment, the aquifer becomes very hot. It's a technology that's being more and more applied And collecting samples of that soil or groundwater during the heating phase is a real concern. Also, exposure to chemical oxidants during in-situ chemical oxidation is also a possibility. If the subsurface is not properly vented, pressures can build up and gases released, leading explosively when the well cap is opened. The ITRC document describes some procedures that can be used to minimize that potential and prevent scalding or chemical burns when sampling. Some other concerns are listed on this slide as well. I won't go into those. Moving to slide 74. This slide presents some concerns expressed by regulators on our team. Drilling in source zones. Some of the techniques for evaluating progress may involve collecting samples from the DNAPL source zone, and precautions must be taken to prevent opening up a hole and allowing the DNAPL to sink further or spread laterally. And this document discusses multi-level sampling in some detail, particularly when drilling in the source zones. Regulators may be unfamiliar with some of the methods recommended for sampling hot media or measuring indicator parameters. Also, techniques for measuring mass flux are very new, and only a limited number of applications have been documented. We attempt to direct the reader to more detailed sources of information on these methods when possible. Another concern expressed by the regulators was statistical evaluation of data. Many regulators are skeptical of data that has been subjected to any statistical manipulation of any kind. And while we may be more comfortable seeing raw data, it can be unwieldy and less clear when the amount of data exceeds our ability to process it. And, you know, as we know, statistics allow project managers to summarize large volumes of data and make objective conclusions. But when presenting that data, just be aware that many regulators may not be comfortable seeing it that way. Another regulatory concern arose when it was suggested that alternate goals for source zone remediation might be more appropriate than MCLs, as I mentioned that earlier. The idea of setting interim goals for the source zone may not be widely accepted by some state regulatory agencies. Move to slide 75. This slide shows or lists some stakeholder concerns. Stakeholders include members of the community, residents, citizen groups, Native American groups with particular interest in a project. And this slide highlights some of the concerns expressed by our public stakeholder rep on the team. First, it should be made clear that the public stakeholders do have a right to be involved in these decisions that affect the outcome of a remedial project. Representatives of the surrounding community should be encouraged to participate in the planning meetings where the project goals are established. Public availability sessions, meetings should be held to solicit public comment on the investigation results as well as the remedial plan. Another issue that was mentioned was that members of the public may overestimate the ability of the technical team to see underground and understand exactly what's going on. Regulators need to explain the limitations of technologies that are used to characterize the DNAPL source zone and how this impacts our ability to measure the performance of the technology. A new issue that we're facing is vapor intrusion. This is particularly true when there are chlorinated DNAPL sources beneath residential areas or commercial structures. Vapor concerns are being voiced more and more by the public. Regulators must not only address the vapor pathway as we investigate and remediate sites, but also consider, you know, vapor attenuation or vapor mitigation as a measure of success. Many of the technologies we discussed today are innovative and emerging technologies. These new approaches to performance verification should be explained to the public in a way that's not too technical. People understand the idea of collecting post-excavation samples, soil samples, to verify cleanup, but they might have a difficulty understanding more complex concepts like mass flux. All right. Move to page seven or slide 76. In summary, we'd like to stress the importance again of planning for performance assessment and working to establish specific measurable performance goals and metrics prior to treatment. Also, goals for the source zone should be achievable as well as measurable. For phased approaches at DNAPL sites, alternate goals, other than drinking water standards perhaps, should be considered for the saturated zone within the source area, at least in the short term. We have described an approach to performance assessment that relies on converging lines of evidence. This involves looking at all the performance data and feedback from the system to gauge success, and not just basing decisions on a single metric. All right, that does it for today's seminar. I appreciate your staying with us, and we'll move to slide 77 for final words.
Thank you, Eric. Before we get to our second session of questions and answers, I'd like to take you to some links to additional resources. On slide 77, you'll see that underlined link to additional resources. If you follow that link, it will take you to our resources that our instructors today have put together for you. You see the list of the prerequisite materials. If you haven't had a chance to look at that, that's available to download. In section 2 on the ITRC specific links, you see the opportunity to download the training slides from today, as well as the document that was the basis for today's training. As you scroll through the ITRC links, you'll see some of the things that our instructors have referred to during today's training, some of the other ITRC resources that are available on related topics. Section 3 has other links, as you can see as you scroll down. These links will continue to be available as a resource to you. So if you would like, you can bookmark this page and come back to it. For those of you who can't stay on the line, along the left, the fourth button down is labeled feedback. We'd like to ask everyone to fill out the feedback form before they leave the site today. Let us know how we're doing on the training in general and specifically answer some questions about today's training class. We do have time now for more questions and answers. If you have muted your phone line, remember to unmute that before you ask questions. If you used our system, it is *7 to unmute. Our simulcast audience is welcome to submit a question using the question mark button. And as you ask your question, please say your name and location. I'm going to start with a simulcast question from Dale Vollmer of Plumley Engineering in New York. What are typical time frames for rebound after Chemox treatment?
This is Ryan. I would say the example that we had in the training presentation, they looked at 13 months afterwards. It typically, again, just to sort of echo what Eric talked about earlier, at least a year of probably quarterly monitoring is good. You certainly should not consider the post remediation sampling at, you know, 1 or 2 or 3 months, because it's likely that a new post treatment equilibrium has not yet been established. So I think the way that project did it was reasonable, where they waited for over a year before they did their final sampling.
This is Konstantinos, and if I can add to that, it certainly could depend on the site specifics. For example, a site that might have what would be considered high groundwater flow velocities might take longer to exhibit the rebound, because the time taking to reach equilibrium to dissolve any small amounts of DNAPL remaining might take quite a bit longer with a high groundwater velocity.
Thank you. Do we have questions from our phone line audience?
I have a question. My name is Doug Say with MacTech in Novi, Michigan. And my question is concerning in situ injection treatment. Have there been comparisons to the various treatments for in situ injection when compared to low permeable soils, such as very stiff clays?
Can I ask you, when you say in situ injection treatment, what specific technology are you referring to?
Potassium permanganate.
You mean what? Are you asking how it can be done, or what the challenges are?
Well, I guess
you're doing that.
What technology would be used best used? I guess in a low permeable stiff clay.
Okay. Yeah. Well, one thing that can be done, and it can be done with chemical oxidation reagents like permanganate. And also bioremediation amendments is to use hydraulic fracturing, where you can actually increase the bulk permeability of a really low permeability system by essentially using a specialized tool to inject under pressure. And the way the technology works is the amendment that you're injecting, which can either be, you know, a solid phase permanganate or a bioremediation amendment, is mixed with a sand propant that fills the fracture. So the fracture is initiated and the soil parts, and the sand mixed with the amendment is used to essentially prop open the fractures. And so this does two things. It increases the permeability of the formation, which it has been shown to do up to two orders of magnitude. But it also emplaces the amendment in these high conductivity fractures, so you actually induce groundwater flow through the parts of the subsurface that now have the amendment in it. So this has been done with, like I said, for bioremediation, for chemical oxidation, and also for zero-valent iron has been emplaced in that way. That's the main way that I know of that is being looked at and being implemented more and more to overcome low permeability, because that's going to be an issue no matter what technology you use. Now, all that being said, electrical resistance heating, if it is a really contaminated, you know, if it's a Dean Apple source area, that technology is effective in low permeability clays and silts and whatnot, because it doesn't rely on actually any media flowing for the treatment. It's the resistive heating, and so it actually works pretty well in that situation.
Okay, that would probably work best. Keeping it quick, I know I got other people, but because
sure.
We have there's a building involved in this equation too, and
mm-hmm.
I'm afraid if we use hydraulic fracturing that it may cause some, because they're shallow soils as well.
Yeah, that's another factor with the fracturing. It actually works better at depth, and if it's too shallow, then the fracture is essentially daylight to ground surface, and you don't get distribution.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
This is Juliana. I'm going to insert a simulcast question. This is from James Schutz at Parsons in New York. What is the mechanism of enhanced mass transfer from DNAPL to soluble phase in bioremediation?
Well, that's an interesting question, and it's one that's sort of up for debate. There are at least three of them that I'm aware of. One is the fact that if you just think of the mass transfer equation, where you've got a mass transfer coefficient, and then in a parenthetical term, you have the concentration essentially at solubility minus the concentration in the aqueous phase. When you initiate something like bioremediation and you're able to reduce the aqueous phase concentration to zero or to something very low, you increase the driving force for the mass transfer, so that increases the rate. The second mechanism is the fact that each sequential daughter product of dechlorination is more soluble than its parent. So TCE is more soluble than PCE, and DCE is more soluble than TCE, and so on. So if the contaminants are rapidly degraded as they dissolve into the aqueous phase, you can actually have a higher contaminant loading in terms of the total moles that are in solution if you have active degradation. Now, the third mechanism is actually an abiotic mechanism, and it's the one that I was talking about at the TAN site. And it's an actual interaction between the electron donor and the DNAPL phase itself. And it's a surfactant-like mechanism. It is not nearly to the extent that a surfactant increases solubility. It's, you know, like I showed, a factor of 20 or a factor of 10. There's been a lab study that showed it was a factor of 16. And that basically is not nailed down in terms of exactly what happens. Myself, I've looked at, you know, what the behavior of interfacial tension between electron donor solutions and PCE DNAPL is. And interfacial tension does go down, but it's not a direct indicator, I guess, of this phenomenon. So it's still up for debate as to why it happens. And the other thing to point out is that in the field, it's hard to separate out what these, you know, how much of a mass transfer is attributable to each one of these mechanisms. What you'll see in the field is you inject an electron donor and you sum up in molar concentrations, you know, all of the chlorinated ethenes plus ethene, and you compare that to what the sum was before you injected anything, and it'll be higher. And that's the evidence for it in the field, but it's hard to attribute or sort of parcel out which mechanism does how much.
Thank you. Do we have additional questions from our phone line audience? I have another simulcast question from Mark Romanel at the New Jersey DEP. Any comments from the presenters regarding limitations in fractured bedrock environments, e.g., monitoring, ability to deliver amendments, etc.?
Well, if I understood the question correctly, with regard to fractured environments?
Bedrock environments.
And is that pertaining directly to performance assessment or to remediation as well?
He has as an example monitoring and the ability to deliver amendments.
I can speak to the ability to deliver amendments. And some of the work that I've done recently is kind of an extension of some previous work done in the oil industry, and that's using different amendments along with the remediation amendment to effectively sweep through the fractured zones more effectively. And that would be basically adding viscosifiers to your amendment. So if you're delivering, let's say, an amendment for bioremediation or rather oxidants or something like that, you would use a viscosifier that will really help sweep through fractured zones a lot better than if you didn't add that. Can someone else talk a little bit more about performance assessment and performance metrics within the fractured zone?
Hi, this is Eric. I think, like any site, you need to know a lot about what's going on subsurface. You need to have a really excellent conceptual site model, and these complex fractured sites are, as you know, difficult to characterize, difficult to get your hands around, and that's why they're kind of the final frontier of remediation. A lot of the same concerns you have during characterization are going to apply to when you want to monitor the progress of the remediation. I mean, some of the parameters or metrics you can measure are, you know, above the surface if you're monitoring, you know, fluid delivery rates and things like that. But to really get your hands around what's occurring underground is very difficult.
Yeah, just to add one final thought on that topic is it can be with a fractured site. You know, for example, the test area north site is fractured basalt, and what was found at that site was in terms of plume scale type behavior. You could essentially treat that aquifer as an equivalent porous medium in terms of modeling numerically and analytically to simulate fate and transport. But when you're talking about actually delivering remedial fluids or monitoring, you have to understand the local heterogeneity. So when you drill a monitoring well, you have to know where the fractures are in that well and which of those fractures, for example, are connected to the area that you're going to be injecting something in, and that's obviously where you need to place your, you know, screen intervals or whatnot, or just your sampling equipment, so that you're sampling the same place where you're injecting, and that, like Eric said, can be very difficult to know if you don't carefully characterize the site.
Well, one final thing I could add, this is Constantinos, is that the experience using tracers can really help in what Ryan is talking about, whether or not some of these fractures are communicating or not, and how far away do they communicate, is something that you can answer with the use of a tracer. Now, that doesn't have to be a partitioning tracer test. That could easily be a conservative tracer test, and that will really help identify these large permeable fractures that will sometimes travel very far away from the site of injection and communicate horizontally as well as vertically. And that would be one other thing that you could use in developing your conceptual site model and then assessing the site in order to know how it's going to behave.
Thank you. Before I go to the next simulcast question, do we have any questions from our phone line audience?
This is Mike Morgenstern at the Savannah River site. I was wondering if you have any recommendations on how you might get a representative sample of hot soil samples. For example, if you get off-gassing prior to analysis, what's the best way to get a good sample?
There's some work done at Cape Canaveral and a protocol developed for collecting hot soil samples. And basically, you submerge it into ice as soon as possible. I think you keep it, you try to keep it cold, and then transfer it into the soil jar. I think it's described in our document. But there's also some published protocols either on NASA's area or on Cluin. I'm sure you could find something.
Thank you, Eric. From our simulcast audience, Skip Ricketts at the Missouri Department of Natural Resources refers to slide 54. Please explain the legend describing contaminant distribution. Aren't all concentrations dissolved?
Yeah, that's a little bit of a misnomer. In this sense, it's intended to mean that they decided to call concentrations less than what's shown on the slide as being outside the source area, and you know that's definitely up for debate. You know, they're basically depicting the source area as the 10 to greater than 100 milligrams per liter, but I think it's just because they didn't want to keep adding contours to this slide.
Thank you. Do we have additional questions from our phone line audience? If not, then we'll wrap up early today. I'd like to thank everyone for attending today, and I'd also like to give a special thanks to our instructors for providing our training content for today's training. If you have not already, please fill out the feedback form. It's from the links page. It's on the left along the top. There's a link to the feedback, and we appreciate getting your information about how you felt the course went today. Thank you.